Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What drives our fascination with evil? Does it mean there is something morally wrong with our society, or is there something to admire in the fact that bad guys seem more in control of their own destinies than those of us shuffling through life on the straight and narrow path? My guest today is fascinated by those questions and by what it says about him and the society in which he lives that he is less interested in a character like Luke Skywalker of Star Wars than by the iconic anti-hero Darth Vader. Author Chuck Klosterman has published two novels and six full-length works of nonfiction, the latest of which is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Chuck, welcome to Think.
Hey, great to be here. Or there.
You explore the idea that the villain is the person who knows the most but cares the least. How did you settle on that definition?
Well, you know, this is in many ways similar to my other books. It's an essay collection, except the difference, I guess, being that the essays are all sort of fundamentally about the same idea. They're all kind of dealing with, I mean, villains is the term and the title, but just bad people, problematic figures, however you want to look at it. So, of course, when you're doing a book like this, you know, or at least the way I'm doing them, I'm just sort of exploring them without a clear idea of what the thesis is to begin with. Mm-hmm. The thesis kind of comes at the end in this kind of scenario. And when I went through the people I was writing about, and I was thinking about, well, is there any kind of field theory or close to a unifying theory that sort of sums up why people feel so uncomfortable with a certain individual while letting someone else doing almost the exact same thing almost skate, you know, just sort of escape without that much sort of scrutiny. And it seemed to be that what really makes people uncomfortable is the idea of someone who almost effortlessly has the tools to understand people or manipulate people or put themselves in a position to succeed, but they have no emotional investment in it. And I think it's that lack of humanity that makes people uncomfortable.
How does that line of thinking relate to some people's accusations that George W. Bush was somehow evil? On the other hand, we know there are many people who think that he was working to defeat evil, but you write here about that idea that some had that he was just a bad guy.
Well, yeah, you see, I feel like George W. Bush does not really fit into the role of villain. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, if we're going to talk about this in partisan terms, if you want to look at a villain in that administration, seems like it would be Dick Cheney. Using the criteria I've kind of constructed, is Bush a person who knew the most and cared the least? Well, I don't think anyone feels like he knew the most. Nobody sort of looked at him as some kind of political mastermind. It looks like a kind of a job he ended up getting almost against his will because of the way his family was built. And as far as caring the least, I think that would be kind of unfair, too. I mean, certainly Kanye West has accused him of not caring about black people, but I don't see him as a paragon of empathy or sort of a feelingless robot. Mm-hmm. He was just someone who was kind of in the position of the job. Of course, if you're a president, there's going to be a large percentage of the country that's going to see you as abhorrent. But I don't think he kind of fits the classic villain role. He doesn't seem to embody or personify a metaphor of evil that's larger than himself.
It is interesting that in the past couple of decades, we have gotten to this place in politics where if you don't like a politician from either party or from outside the party system, the first place you go is evil, right? You don't say they're incompetent necessarily. You somehow people really latch onto this idea that they are deliberately ruining the country. And people say that about Barack Obama all the time.
It is. It's a strange thing. I mean, Or maybe it's not so strange. Maybe it's predictable. All I know is it's increased in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it is really sort of amazing to me that going into, say, the 2000 election, you know, you were having kind of a sophisticated intellectual argument about Bush and Gore. Somebody would often sort of forward the idea that, well, they're just sort of puppets that are the same, and they're being controlled by the same forces. And there was even a rock video by the band Rage Against the Machine where it just showed image after image of Bush and Gore saying the same thing. This was a real fear. The fact that these guys weren't different at all doesn't feel like this. The country's not like that now. No one seems to forward that idea. So if you have this concept that the two principal political sides in America have nothing in common, they're just totally adversarial. It's very easy, I think, to slip into this idea that's like, well, it's like good and evil. Mm-hmm. What I believe in is the good side, you know?
Well, and then, you know, you also take on this idea that good and evil, rather than sort of assembling a collection of our actions and choices, we tend to look at them as ingrained characteristics.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably true. You know, I mean, when you say ingrained, that's one thing I don't directly talk about this in this book, and yet I suppose you could argue it's involved in every essay, is sort of the problem of free will mm-hmm. as it applies to bad behavior or evil. You know, I mean, if you don't believe in free will, you're essentially saying, well, we're all characters in a play, just sort of working out what we were predestined to do. There are no heroes or villains. But once we accept that free will exists, if we do, if we accept that people are making decisions on their own, and the way that if someone is doing bad things, they are culpable because it was their own agency, well, then we want to sort of understand that individual. We don't really look at it as a way to live. We look at it as a way that this person is living. You know, I think that the more you study any kind of person in the media, the tendency is to see their actions less as a social reaction to things and more as a personal deal, that it's really isolated to them.
Yeah. Early in the book, you take on Machiavelli, who seems to be one of the most misunderstood real people in history. What do we learn by reading The Prince with an understanding of the context in which it was written and of what Machiavelli was trying to accomplish?
Well, you know, I don't even know if I would say Machiavelli is misunderstood. I would say he's just not understood or considered that much. What is considered is the term Machiavellian, mm-hmm. which people understand. That if you're trying to describe someone who seems to see power as a justification of its own, that that power in and of itself has value, and that the important thing about being a leader is to attain leadership and keep that in control. Well, then you're like, well, this is sort of the guy who forged this, I created this system that kind of leads us down this road to ruin. When in the truth, you know, like, we don't really know, we'll never exactly know what Machiavelli's motivation was for writing The Prince, but seems like it was probably really high-level sarcasm, like true irony. Irony so successful that as time passed, people took the message literally. And what he was really doing is saying, you know, it was a strange deal. As crazy as this sounds, prior, like to the age of Machiavelli, and even during his lifetime, there was this idea that if you were going to be king, if you were going to be the leader, what you needed to do was be virtuous, because people would be more likely to follow a virtuous person. So therefore, anybody who was in power and successful at keeping that power, it was like a tautological argument, must be virtuous. Like, you know, they're succeeding as a leader, and the way to succeed as a leader is by being virtuous, so therefore anyone in a position of power has virtue. I think Machiavelli was probably looking at this saying, it's insane that we think this.
Wait a second, right.
Yeah, this is totally an illusion that the way people attain power are through the almost the polar opposite of virtue. So he describes what somebody would theoretically need to do to attain power. He was actually describing what was already happening. But that's not how it seemed. Somehow, because he had this consciousness, he had the ability to sort of say, well, if you wanted to be a ruler, this is what you would do. People just assume that, well, his understanding of this is almost bad in and of itself. Like, his problem, his failure was consciousness. So now he's, you know, like a figure whose name will always be associated with terrible behavior, but I don't know, I think the sophisticated view is probably to look at that and go like, well, we decided that he's a villain because he understands how villains work.
Yeah. He put a name to something that had existed all along, but everybody sort of turned a blind eye toward it. Chuck Klosterman is my guest. His new book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. You write about that you used to think of musicians that you hated as villainous, whether you saw them as lazy or untalented or hypocritical. How have those perceptions dissolved for you as you've gotten older?
Well, you know, I think what happens is this. When you're a young person, the things you love and the things you hate are almost a way to construct your personality. Mm-hmm. Like, you're still becoming who you are. You're not even sure who you are. And you certainly have a sense that other people have no sense of who you are. So how do you do that? Well, you do it partially by expressing the things that are important to you, you know, and like, you know, wearing a T-shirt of your favorite band, but also by expressing vitriol to the band you hate, in that this is a signal for other people that I don't like Bruce Springsteen, so therefore I'm against whatever you assume Bruce Springsteen represents.
Right.
And then you age, you know, and at some point you become the person you are. And then it's not that you're using these bands to signal to other people how you feel. It's more like you're actually trying to understand yourself and see yourself in these things. So, you know, there was a point in my life where I really hated the Eagles. And, you know, I saw the Big Lebowski, and, you know, and the main character hates the Eagles, and
right.
That was so validating to me at the time because I aspired to be like this character. That character, to me, was who I wanted to see myself in this person.
You wanted to be the dude.
Yes.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
In some weird way, I wanted to be the kind of person who had his values.
Right, right.
But then in 2003, I was working at Spin Magazine, and I got the Eagles' Greatest Hits sent to me, one of the, you know, many iterations of a Greatest Hits record. It was the newest one.
Mm-hmm.
And I started listening to it, and suddenly it felt different to me. I started experiencing that record actually as music, not as a cultural signpost.
Hmm.
You know, and it started to dawn on me something that maybe is kind of obvious, but I don't think many critics like to admit. I realized that my relationship to all this music was like a loop inside my mind, that I had these ideas and I was injecting them into the music and hearing them back to me.
Hmm.
And once you realize that you can't control how you think or how you feel, it makes it very difficult to take your own opinion seriously. And it was sort of a paralyzing scenario for me to suddenly realize that I didn't have control over my thoughts. And frankly, I don't think most people do. And I think that one of the myths about being alive is this idea that we can actually have freedom of thought. I think for the most part, even with free will, our thoughts are kind of closed down by the world around us, our experiences, and our inability to sort of break free from whatever sort of construction that we've made in our own skull.
Well, it's so interesting because it would seem as if you'd be happier overall if the sound of Lion Eyes in like Muzak in the Elevator doesn't, you know, reduce you to this like impotent rage. But you were sort of left feeling empty when you didn't have this hatred.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is totally true. It seems as though if the only experience I was having with this music was the sound wave,
mm-hmm.
you know, did it sound pleasurable to my eardrum? That would seem better, you know? I could either just listen to it if I liked it or not listen to it if I don't. But, you know, life is confusing, and I think I feel probably compared to most people especially confused. I think it's shocking to me that I'm 41 now and the world is so much more confusing to me than when I was 21. It's really disturbing. And, you know, I didn't know what my life would be like 20 years later when I was 21, but I did think I would have a greater clarity about reality. And I feel the opposite has happened. And my inability to even understand, to have this relationship to music outside of itself, is part of that. You know, what the Eagles meant to me was very clear at one point, unclear now.
My guest is author Chuck Klosterman. His new book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Chuck Klosterman. His new book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. When you talk about heroes real and imagined, there is the you have a chapter here where you consider Batman the sort of fictional superhero character, and the real life figure of Bernard Goetz, who people may recall was called the subway vigilante in the 80s. He shot some teenagers that he said had tried to attack him in a subway.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you go through this exercise understanding that Batman is not real. But you ask this question like why do we love the idea of Batman and we root for him, even though he's sort of running around solving crimes he wasn't asked to take on? And yet Bernard Goetz strikes us as really creepy and inappropriate in many ways. And some of that you think may have to do with the way that Goetz behaved after this was all over.
Well, I think it totally was, and it is weird. I'm using this example, you know, Batman seems kind of ridiculous, but I do feel, I guess, in a slightly more serious way, that vigilantism creates a unique problem in terms of this polarity between good people and bad people. If you say to somebody, any smart person, you know, what do you think of vigilante justice? Should vigilante justice be part of the culture? They will, of course, say no. They will say, you know, due process is essential. You can't allow people to go out and you know, take justice into their own hands. The vigilante is a villain. But then you give them a sketch of a real-life situation without detail. You say, let's say there was a crime-ridden city, which New York was in the mid-'80s.
Yeah. You know?
There's a man riding the subway. He's approached by three teens. Who seem very threatening. They may have screwdrivers. You know, that was the rumor at the time. You know, he reacts with a gun, and he shoots these guys, and he flees. Well, everybody then goes like, well, okay, I can kind of create a scenario where I'm in that guy's shoes. I can imagine a situation where I'm in a dangerous place, and I'm constantly in jeopardy, and this is guys pushing back against the criminals. So then, you know, it almost seems heroic. And for the first 48 to 72 hours after the shootings, when Bernard Goetz was on the run, no one really knew who he was, anything about him, he was a beloved figure. His approval rating, particularly in New York, was through the roof. But then he comes forward, and all of a sudden, he says things like shooting those guys was easier than typing, and that he wished he could have shot them all, but he ran out of bullets, and he shows no remorse. And then we find out these things that he said at a community meeting that seemed racist. Over time, we learn these details of his life. He now lives in this apartment in New York with a bunch of squirrels. He's become an advocate for the squirrel community. All these sort of things that make him seem unusual and bizarre and not representative of society as a whole. So then it swings back. Then he's bad again. If he could have somehow remained in that thin channel in between where he was an unknown vigilante who must have been doing something to serve people as a whole or was the manifestation of a good person in a bad scenario, then he wouldn't be this villain. But now he is to virtually everyone. The only people you find now who still have a positive view of Bernard Goetz are people who lived in New York at that time and experienced crime. You know, even young people in New York, if they remember their parents liking Bernard Goetz, they're now like, well, of course, you know, now we know the truth or whatever. So the situation with Batman, and the reason I use this as an example, is because, of course, we know all this stuff about Batman. We know his origin story. We know Batman is good, you know. But if Batman were real, and we had no pre-existing idea of this, DC character, if all of a sudden there's a guy on the streets of New York, or let's say Dallas, all of a sudden on the streets of Dallas, there's this guy dressed like a winged mammal, and he's beating people up, And granted, the people he's beating up are bad, but he seems to be doing it just on his own. You know, how would the media cover that, and how would people feel about it? It's a very interesting problem.
Well, and of course, this leads us directly to the case of George Zimmerman, which has been settled now in court, but clearly has not been settled in the minds of the American public.
Well, you know, in the Zimmerman case, of course, it's going on right now, and I'm doing a lot of interviews for this book, and it's about villains, so people are asking me about this. But this that situation, in some ways, is unique in that when you, say, follow Twitter or Facebook or any of these things, or even just, you know, in the broadest sense, you know, watching CNN, watching MSNBC, watching Fox, I don't feel like people are really dealing with what happened. I think that there is just a consensus that your reaction to this verdict says something about how you view everything about society.
Right.
So I see these people reacting in a way that, you know, doesn't necessarily, to me, have any relationship to the reality of the incident, which I will admit I don't know that much about. All I know is what I've learned through television in the newspapers, which means I know almost nothing.
Right. Yeah, you know, it occurred to me, and I guess, you know, maybe this is how a journalist thinks, but I'd have to almost sit in court and see and hear all the evidence to make what I feel to be a truly educated guess, because so much of the information we receive feels either incomplete or frankly biased.
Well, absolutely, and here again is a case where less information gives us a different kind of clarity.
Yeah.
If someone were to say, hey, you know what, there was a shooting in a state, an old guy shot a young kid, how should we pursue this? They would be like, well, the media should stay out of it. It should just be in the courtroom. Any sort of interference with the prosecution or the defense is going to sully the verdict. You know, but that's not how it is in this case. In this case, it's all personal. We know that the person who was shot was seemingly an innocuous young black man. We know the guy who did the shooting seemingly pursued him and at least has taken on the sort of social perception of someone who was kind of looking for violence. And this, of course, has a meaning because, you know, the president was involved. That was a unique scenario. You know, how often is the president sort of expressing an idea about a case that has not yet went to trial? That, you know, that when that happened, I was sort of like, well, obviously he's going to be found guilty, you know, and then, of course, I was wrong again, you know.
And then we have this, we have a great, I guess, comfort with ambiguity when it comes to our fictional characters. You know, you think of a character like Tony Soprano, and my guess has always been that he was sort of a reminder of this idea that we can all be narcissistic and we can, you know, assume that we're doing the right thing and feel like the hero of our own story, even when we're terrible people. But, you know, huge numbers of people tuned in to watch this guy killing people and cheating on his wife and doing just any number of horrible things.
Well, yeah, you know, described on paper, he's almost an objectively bad character, but yet he's beloved.
Yeah.
Now, why is that? Well, I think that has to do with something that's even a little, maybe a little more uncomfortable. When you look at art over time, it has gradually moved toward realism. It first happened in literature. You can see this in the 19th and 18th century. Then, you know, in you move into the 20th century and in the 70s. With like the res of the auteur movement in film, suddenly it became popular to see, you know, Godfather-type characters, problematic characters who were the heroes in rock music. That obviously happened. That was part of the success of rock was its appealed to youth culture because the heroes weren't two-dimensional or one-dimensional. And it finally happened in television in the 90s, really with The Sopranos, now with Mad Men and Breaking Bad and The Wire. And I think what this is like, you know, Tony Soprano, yes, he does these terrible things. He's technically a villain. But we now associate villainy with realism.
Hmm.
He seems like a more realistic character than, say, you know, a purely good sheriff in an old Western. You know, and a lot of these shows now that we adopt as the high end of television, they focus on, you know, pretty much objectively bad people, but they feel real to us. Like, we see more of ourselves in these bad people than in the good ones.
Hmm. You know, I was reading this book on my way to our annual family vacation. We went to Northern California. We took the family to Alcatraz. And I was so glad that I had this all to think about when I was touring there, because you sort of go through this prison and we have this get tough on crime culture. But when you go to Alcatraz, even the entire tour is set up, even though some of it's narrated by former guards and all that, the tour is set up to give you the POV of the individuals who were incarcerated there and how awful their lives were.
I know. It's a strange thing, isn't it? It's sort of like you need to understand these people who are there because they murdered someone. Have some sympathy for what happened after they got after they killed somebody. But I mean, I suppose part of it has to do is the kind of person who's interested in seeing a prison on an island is probably the kind of person more susceptible to sort of trying to understand the mind of a problematic person. Hmm. You know, if you're the kind of person who has a strict black and white view of the world, that, you know, almost like, in some respects, I see this in Edward Snowden and stuff, that these people who have like almost a naive view of right and wrong, like Luke Skywalker, the kind of way an 8 or 9 year old sees the world, you know. Well, that person's not interested in taking a tour of Alcatraz. You know, that's not going to appeal to them. The person it appeals to is the person who likes the grayness of life, who sort of likes the complexity of good and bad, and is sort of maybe in some ways perversely interested in punishment.
Well, yeah, I was wondering about that too on the trip. I was thinking, maybe I do have sort of a guilty conscience that I can imagine myself being trapped there with all these other people, and maybe there's something to that as well.
I mean, this is maybe kind of going on a tangent, but you know, the first books I wrote were the first one was about like hair metal and growing up in the Midwest and listening to, you know, Kiss and Motley Crue and stuff. And the second book I wrote was called Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and it was about kind of low culture. And at the time I wrote those books, you know, the reaction tended to be, like, I kind of felt these things are stuffed with ideas, you know, but people only wanted them to interview me about Pantera,
right,
or about Van Halen, you know, or about Pamela Anderson. They were really into the tangible content. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, boy, you know, here I have these ideas about the way culture is absorbed by people and sort of its meaning, and they just want to talk about the specifics. Now I write this book, and it's almost gone the other way, because ultimately, to me, this book is sort of like your trip to Alcatraz. Hmm. It's an intellectual, fun pursuit, okay? It's like I'm writing about things and subjects typically aren't entertaining, but it's like, here's an entertaining way to think about D.B. Cooper or about O.J. Simpson, you know? It's like, you know, but the questions, of course, now, because of the topic, is much more serious.
Yeah.
Like, this book is taken much more serious in the same way that my early books, I felt, weren't taken seriously enough. So I guess I'm just a malcontent. I'm just never happy with how anybody responds to anything I do.
Well, let's talk about D.B. Cooper, because I thought that was a fascinating essay as well. D.B. Cooper, of course, for people who don't remember, is the guy who hijacked an airplane, got all this cash, jumped out of the plane, and the question is, did he survive with the cash? Did he perish somehow and just was never found? But if you look at the facts of the case, he was a hijacker. He didn't kill anybody, but he hijacked a plane, something that we are very sensitive to these days and don't take anything but a really negative view of.
Yeah, to me, that was all, like, I was into D.B. Cooper as a little kid. I saw an episode of, there used to be this show called In Search Of.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
Leonard Nimoy was the host, okay? So I see this episode of D.B. Cooper. I've always kind of been fascinated by it. Part of the reason I wrote about it is because it's in a section of the book where I talk about villains who are not villainized, or whatever, you know, people who do villainous things and are not only not villainized, but almost lionized. But I do think what you said is maybe the most interesting detail. I mean, it is amazing to me that there was a time in the not too distant past where a guy brings a bomb onto a plane for money. And people are like, we love him. Like, there are still places in the Pacific Northwest where they have celebrations on the day of his hijacking, you know? And we have this one, you know, there was a hijacking culture in the world in the 60s and early 70s, you know? I wouldn't say it's common, but it wasn't totally unforeseen for someone to hijack a plane and say, like, oh, let's go to Cuba or whatever, you know? You know, that has changed so much because of this one super traumatic incident, you know. So it's not that it's confusing. I'm not confused by this, but I do think it's an interesting change in sort of the American zeitgeist. That something that was once seen as sort of like a cowboy move is now a terrorist move.
What do you make of the fact that there are, unfortunately, we have a long history in humankind of you know, massive villains who have killed hundreds of thousands or even millions of people, but Hitler is like the one. You write a lot of really interesting stuff about this.
Excuse me, I missed the last part.
I mean, your essay on that is very interesting, about why Hitler became the symbol of that sort of behavior. But he is unfortunately not alone in history in the magnitude of his crimes.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just you look at somebody like Stalin, you look at somebody like Pol Pot, you know, you could say, you know, these figures, you know, how is, you know, Idi Amin, for example, why is Hitler seen worse than Idi Amin? It's definitely would be more problematic if I made a bad Hitler joke on this program right now than if I made a bad Stalin joke.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like if I made a bad Hitler joke, it could end my career. And I was like, so why is that? Well, part of it has to do with he has become this, and this is, again, not the most brilliant insight, but sort of the placeholder for the most evil thing. You know, the distance of his acts don't seem that far. They happen. There's many people in this country who have family who experience this. So when we talk about Hitler, it's just sort of like Hitler has to remain real. He can't remain an idea or become an idea. Like when we talk about Hitler, we're talking about that person. You can go to a 5-year-old kid or a 6-year-old kid and say, do you know who Hitler is? Can you draw a picture of him? And very often they could. They could draw a very simple face with a little mustache. It needs to be a real thing to people. So whenever we use Hitler for, you know, like when Woody Allen makes a joke about Hitler, or when Bob Dylan sings about Hitler, or when David Bowie sings about Hitler, the stakes are different. And it has less to do with the act itself, which of course was super egregious, mm-hmm. but more to do with this idea that Hitler has to be alive in our mind, you know.
My guest is author Chuck Klosterman. His new book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm speaking this hour with author Chuck Klosterman. His new book is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, one other thing, just to go back for a moment to the question of Hitler, Chuck, is the idea that one of the things that he, one of the ways that the sort of idea of Hitler functions for us today is as this embodiment of all evil in a way that maybe previous centuries really still sort of had an idea of the devil. And now, because of the way we sort of think about Satan, you know, some people may believe that Satan is an actual entity, but you know, a lot of people picture like a guy in a red unitard and little horns, and Satan somehow doesn't seem as frightening as that concept of embodied evil once did.
Well, I mean, not only is Satan less scary to people, in popular culture, his connotation is mostly positive. If you listen to a song like The Devil Went Down to Georgia,
yeah.
The devil's a reasonable guy. It's like challenges a guy to a fiddle contest and loses, and like, okay, here's a gold fiddle. You win, you know. You know, they make movies about the devil, and it's like Al Pacino plays him. Like, you know, it would be if somebody made a film or made a television show where the devil was a character and was, you know, just like a the most kind of classically Christian perception of that. That show would be seen as being pro-Christian. You wouldn't be able to make a show like that and just have the devil be like the bad guy. It would then have a whole different connotation. So we don't use that so much anymore. I mean, it's strange. You'll see you know, a statistic in Newsweek or something. It will say, you know, 90% of Americans believe in angels or something. It'll always be like a crazy number. And yet, if your only relationship to society is through the culture, we feel like we're continually becoming more secular. And I sometimes think that the discomfort and the polarization of America is part of a manifestation of this, in that the people in this country, for the most part, are as Christian or more Christian than they were in the past, but there's very few extensions of that in the media. So it almost feels like both sides feel like they're dealing with this completely out-of-whack world that has no relationship to how they actually live and think.
Do you think there's something energizing about feeling outraged?
Maybe. I hate that. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I feel outraged, I find myself going like, what am I really outraged about? Is it the issue at hand, or is it something about myself? I mean, I'm not Spock. I'm not the world's most rational person, but I certainly aspire to it. You know, like you aspire to sort of see the world in a real term. And if you look at the world in real terms, you know, some would say, well, you should be outraged all the time. Other people would say, like, well, there's two sides to everything. And I guess I fall closer to that latter category. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the injection of emotion into things like the George Zimmerman case does not improve our understanding of what happened or what should have happened.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that if you pick a side, you can always find lots of people, or at least numerous people, to stand there with you. If you stay in the middle, people almost think of you as less intelligent or somehow less decisive and less thoughtful, frankly.
Well, I mean, because the thing, okay, if you are on one side of a debate, you're against the opposite side, right? If you're in the middle, technically, both sides are against you.
Yeah.
You know, you're both sides see you as, I don't know if they necessarily see you as less intelligent, but they certainly might see you as part of the problem. Talking about abortion or whatever, both sides, you know, think that there's a very clear response to how you're supposed to feel about abortion, both, you know, pro-choice, pro-life, whatever. So if you're in the middle, if you say like, well, you know, in many ways, this question is too complicated for politics or religion, you know, then both sides see you as being against them. So I guess if I am a villain in my own life, it might be because I am unwilling to take a side without total certainty that side is irrefutably right, and I rarely feel that way.
And that ultimately, it's ironic that in journalism, then that sort of middle ground becomes symbolically annihilated. Whereas, you know, journalists and are supposed to stay neutral and cover things from a neutral arena, but then they communicate ostensibly neutral information by taking side A and side B, or side black and side white, and then contrasting them rather than sort of exploring what's in between.
Well, yeah, you know, it's a problem, but I have to say it's a better problem than the alternative we seem to have adopted. There seems to have been a thinking that happened in the 80s, particularly in the 90s, that, well, you know, no human is objective, so attempts at objectivity are inherently false. And that's the wrong way to look at it. The idea as a journalist is you're supposed to be objective by understanding your own biases and compensating for that. Nobody thinks that a person has no stake in a given issue, especially if they're covering, you know, abortion or the death penalty or whatever. But the idea to me always has been is you spend a lot of time sort of nurturing your own self-awareness to become aware of how you feel about things, and then say, okay, that's my bias. I need to weigh this when I do the reporting. But people want the opposite. People, that's why MSNBC and Fox have succeeded. Because what people really want is hearing someone reflect their bias. They want to hear someone say what they already believe. And that's, I think, probably the biggest problem facing journalism in the, from this point on. And I don't see any solution to it because people don't want it. People don't want objectivity.
Well, yeah, and who doesn't want to hear that all reasonable people agree with you, you know?
Well, I know, a smart person, to me. Like, you know, to my view would be, that's what a smart person would say, I don't feel comfortable if everyone's agreeing with me because my experience in life shows me that full agreement typically causes disaster. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. A few months ago on this show, we had a discussion about the nature of heroes and how we perceive them. And I'm curious about your opinion on this. Does the presence of an identified hero, that or a villain, rather, that people agree on, does that automatically require the nomination and election of a hero of some kind to counter that villain?
Well, I don't know if I agree with that. I certainly think that you know, even when you were describing in the intro to this show, you described Darth Vader as an anti-hero. I think that in the past, he would have just been seen as a villain. But now anti-hero is sort of probably the way a lot of people would view that.
He gets redeemed in the end.
Excuse me?
He does get redeemed in the end.
Yes, he does. That's kind of the twist. But I'm almost dealing with, like, the first two films, you mm-hmm. know. If there's a villain, does there have to be a hero? Well, I mean, if there's a hero, there almost has to be a villain, so I suppose it's almost tautological. I don't know. That's a good question. I've never really considered that because, to me, the idea of a hero is really just, that's a construct, too, and that if we spend enough time thinking about the hero, he or she's not going to seem heroic.
Hmm. You know, it's always interesting when we talk about, you know, there's obviously sports heroes, but then there are sort of villains that emerge. You know, they've cheated or they've been found to commit crimes, and then we don't quite know what to do with a hero that suddenly gets tossed into the other column and becomes a villain.
Well, sports add the kind of another level of complexity because we are programmed. In fact, sports themselves are created with the idea of rooting for and against people.
Sure.
That, you know, if you live in Dallas, you can root for the Cowboys and you root against the Redskins, and that you can almost, you know, you can make Eli Manning a villain simply because he lives in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But then, so let's try to get outside of that. Let's, like, look at the sports figures sort of objectively. LeBron James is somebody who has toggled back and forth on this. Somebody who initially was seen as, oh, here's this guy from Akron, and he's playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers, so he's like the ultimate local boy who's staying local, and you know, he's going to turn this franchise around. Then he goes to Miami, and everything shifts. Then he becomes this horrible person, by far the most hated athlete, more hated than Tiger Woods was at one point. But then he has success. Now we're kind of crawling back in the other way. The thing with sports that makes this issue so complex is we really can't make these judgments really until the person is retired, because while they're active, their performance informs our understanding of them, and it can make a bad person seem good. You know, Ben Roethlisberger, quarterback of the Steelers, gets accused essentially of rape, you know, suspended for 4 games, he vilified figure in every possible context, but he comes back, plays pretty well, and now we talk about him as a football player again. So what was the meaning of that period where we viewed him as a bad citizen? It's complicated.
And, of course, there's always, you know, if you have been labeled a villain, you can always turn around and accuse the media of sort of setting you up. I'm thinking of the Paula Deen case now, where lots of people are furious to have discovered that Paula Deen allegedly made these comments, and I guess she did make them in court affidavits. And people are horrified, but her fans are saying, well, people are making more of this than they should, and she is not, in fact, a villain and shouldn't be conceived that way.
Well, it's a complicated deal. Apparently, her restaurants are actually doing better now than they were before this scandal because of people who associate her as someone who is extra real because she's kind of racist. It's just weird. It's bizarre. So that raises the question. going to her restaurant. Does that make you implicit in racism? I don't, you know, if the majority of people hate you, there's still going to be a sliver who loves you more. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, I think if that's like certainly, I mean, the fact that this book exists, okay, that I write this book that I wouldn't say is sympathetic toward villains, but open to the idea that we may be misunderstanding them. Okay, the fact that this book exists, like, why did I choose to write this book instead of a book celebrating and examining heroes? Because one's more interesting.
Why are villains more interesting?
Because they're more real. I feel like they're more real to people. If we use these characters, fictional or non-fictional, and in a way, even non-fictional characters are fictional to us. I mean, you know, in many ways, Bill Clinton is a character to me.
Uh-huh.
I have no relationship with him except through my television and through the newspaper, whatever the case may be. And the fact of the matter is, when there's a heroic figure, you know, like the guy who landed the plane on in the Hudson River, Scully, you know.
Yeah.
I don't see myself in him. Like, I don't see any part of myself. I see a guy who did something that you know, maybe if I was in a situation I could do, but I don't relate to it. Mm-hmm. But the villain we do relate to, because every one of us has some fear that maybe we are bad. You know, that in a Christian culture that has been ingrained in everyone, including the non-Christians, the possibility that we are bad and that we are sinful and all of these things. And that's no matter how we live, that worry exists. And when we see like a Walter White character in Breaking Bad,
yeah,
that seems like something that could happen to us, not in totality, but partially, that we could be put in a situation where we're forced to do something bad and find out we like it or we're good at it. And actually, it's closer to who we really are. So when people say villains are more interesting, or when I say villains are more interesting, in many ways what I'm saying is they're just closer to the state of human nature.
Are you surprised that we're not more ashamed of our fascination with villains?
I mean, you could argue that we are, in the sense that we still label them as villains. We won't go all the way and decide that they're good. Like, no one will never say Tony Soprano was a hero. We don't mm-hmm. feel comfortable saying that, partially because it would be inaccurate, but also because we need to identify that we have an intellectual relationship, at least, to shame. We know it's bad. We like it anyway.
That's interesting. So you can relate to Tony Soprano when he's, like, trying to get along with his wife and having problems with his mother, but then when he, you know, when he whacks three guys in the course of a night, then you have to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, well, and it's, you know, when he's dealing with Carmella and they have a bad relationship, many people who are married are like, I've had that fight. I've had that fight. Maybe the reason I had that fight is because I'm the bad person. I'm at fault. Well, of course, then he goes out and kills someone. And we think to ourselves, well, I would never do that. But are they on the same continuum?
Hmm.
Is the things that I do in my life, like, you know, I don't commit major crimes or anything, but I do wonder about my own motives for things and how distant my motives are for the small bad things I do in relation to the really terrible things that men do to other men.
Writer Chuck Klosterman has published 2 novels and 6 full-length works of nonfiction, the latest of which is called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains Real and Imagined. Chuck, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones from Joe Bellotti, and Christine McConnell did the podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.